You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Whamgoat presents the Band Flip Podcast.
What is up? Welcome to this episode of Whamgoat's Band Flip Podcast. This week I am joined by Maurizio from the long-running Canadian death metal, awesome metal band, Cataclysm. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today, Maurizio?
How you doing, man? I'm doing good. How about yourself?
Pretty good. I was going to start it out by saying bonjour because I'm half French-Canadian, so...
Oh, are you?
Okay, yeah, cool. I just didn't want you to start spouting off French because I don't speak it fluently by any means, so, you right. know, I can kind of jumble it
so,
around
yeah,
my head.
I mean, we, you know, what's funny with Cataclysm is that three-quarters of the band now lives in the States.
Yeah.
But we're all Canadian, except for the new drummer, James. He's actually British and Italian. So it's, but he lives in Los Angeles. We're all over the place. We're the real mutts, you know, metal right now, the way it looks. I live in Florida. My guitar player is in Texas, and the only one guy is in Canada now, and it's... Oh. Won't leave it, you know. It's Steph, my bass player. He's like, I'm staying. Yeah. You know, so that's it.
My family family spent time up there and down here throughout my life. So I've gone to and from a lot.
Like Montreal or
Quebec for the most part. Montreal. I mean, periodically we'd visit Montreal. Obviously, you have to. It's like the most European city in Canada. But we stayed around Ottawa, Gatineau, and Hull, and that side of things.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. You said them right too, like pronunciation's right. Yeah.
Well, I've grown up with those words being said, spoken to me endlessly for the last decades, you know. So, right. Big year for you guys. You guys have your 15th studio album, Goliath, coming out, and it should be out this week as you're listening to this podcast. So make sure you pre-save it, go purchase it, go stream it. But how does it feel to know that you have that large of a body of work? It's like 15 full-length albums with some other things thrown in the mix along the way, but you guys have been crushing it since the early 90s. So,
yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, you don't realize until you step back and you look at it and you're like, 15 records, holy shit. I mean, that's like an album every 2 years, kind of, you know, like if you look at that perspective, it's a lot of work, and it's a whole body of work. A lot of bands don't even get there. Yeah. The fact that we've been able to do it is kind of crazy. Also, you know, we've never been that band that was immense, you know, that blew up super big and, you know, could merit that. Like, we're just, I think, very consistent, hard workers. You know, consider ourselves like blue collar, you know, death metal band that needs to work and stay there. And, you know, I think the fact that we were always a little bit under the radar was a huge motivational factor for Cataclysm, you know, because we didn't have maybe the same type of pressures that some other bands had, but we had the pressures of, you want to stay relevant, you got to work and stay out there, you know. And so we were lucky with that, I think. It was kind of a blessing in disguise, you know.
Is that something that's kind of always been the band's like operator, you know, MO? Is that kind of like you've always felt like the underdog and you have to like grind a little harder than the other people, or was that something that you have adopted after a couple years of, you know, grinding it out?
We got noticed fairly quickly. The band, I believe, from what I remember, we were formed in 91, end of 91, and in 92 we got a record deal with Nuclear Blast. You know, it was like, not even a year in, we were like already signed. We had no experience. I think that at the beginning, we were all eyes on Cataclysm type of band. We were so extreme and out of this world that it turned a lot of heads around. We were at some point named the most extreme band on the planet, you know, with the first records we did. And I think that after that, there's that movement and that change happens with any industry and everybody. So then it was more about, what do we really want to do? So we focused on writing songs instead of trying to be the most extreme band in the world. you know, because then the cryptopsies came out, all the, you know, heavy shit came out, and you, everybody's competing for speed, and we wanted to compete on making songs. And yeah. I think that's where the challenge came in for Cataclysm after that. And we always took the position of the underdog, even when we go on stage and we are headlining, we take the position of an underdog. We, even if we know the crowd's there for us, for example, we'll do a show in Germany and it's a 2,000 people crowd. I don't care. We're still going to play it like if it's our last show, you know, like yeah. we have to prove ourselves. And I think that's kind of encrusted in Cataclysm, and it's been there. And that's, I think, been a good factor for us, you know?
Yeah. I definitely want to kind of like touch what you just said. You were going for speed, and then you want to write, you know, better songs, or songs, so to speak, later in your, you know, early tenure there. You do a great mix of both of those things on some of the new tracks on the new record. You know, I think, what is it, Thanks. Die as a King starts out pretty intensely fast, but kind of matures into a great, you know, a great song for the entire length of it. So, you know, it's, when you guys were starting out in 91, like how many like speed bands were around you in that Montreal area that like kind of pushed you, or, you know, drove you to want to do like that kind of extreme death metal sound?
There wasn't too many. There was a few that were more like standard death metal, you know, mid-paced. Mm-hmm. Cataclysm came, you know, swinging out of the bat, like really heavy. And we had a different lineup at that time where we had a different singer as well. I used to play bass. Yep. I formed a band playing bass. And the singer we had was very into extreme stuff. And he was like, we have to be the craziest band on earth, you know, like that was his thing. So it was the marriage of all these type of different influences. For example, I'm into groove stuff, you know, like I was a big fan of Pantera, thrashy stuff like Testament. I brought more of that kind of vibe into, you know, Fear Factory, Machine Head. Like I brought more kind of that vibe into the band. And then my bass player was more into Dimmu Borgir and some of the black metal mm-hmm. stuff. And my guitar player is a Maiden fan. So it was that combination. If you listen to Cataclysm, you'll hear all of those things. Right. And then the singer at the time and whoever came into the band always had that big death metal influence on top of it. So it was kind of a mix of all that stuff. And when we are young, you know, like you got to put yourself in the pit. Like I'm in my late 40s right now. When I started this, I was 15, 16 years old.
Yeah.
And at that time, it was all about trying to impress the other guy, you know, next to you in the practice spot. And like, well, look at this guy. He thinks he's fast. You know, like, let's do it. Let's do 25 riffs in this song, you know, just to beat the other band. You know, so we come from that innocence, right? And it's that innocence, I think, that a lot of bands are lacking a little bit now coming out, right? There's a lot of great bands out there that are doing some new stuff and getting noticed and all that stuff. But there's a lot of people that are so desperate to get recognized and liked right away that are kind of copying whatever's working. Mm. We were a different breed of band going into like, oh, this is cool. This is cool. Let's match it all. Let's go out there and create our own thing that's going to be crazier than everybody. And I think it was that drive that kind of got us noticed, you know, yeah. or else it wouldn't happen. Also, being in Canada was a disadvantage at that time.
Yeah,
we had to work. That's why people ask a lot, what's wrong with the water in Canada? Because the bands are so crazy and, you know, progressive or whatever. It's because we have to work harder to get noticed. You know, we're like with the big neighbors in the United States, that eats all the attention, all the bands coming out of New York at that time, Florida. Mm-hmm. We, you know, who's going to go look at the guy that's in like Quebec City or Montreal, yeah. you know, it was like, so that's why you got the Voivods, you got the Cryptopsy, the Annihilators, everybody, Strapping Young Lad, you know, like all these Devin Townsend, we all come out with original stuff. And it's because we had to, you know, mm-hmm. also. And I think that was the pressure at that time.
So I want to kind of touch base on the early Canadian scene too, if you don't mind, because it's something that I'm interested in, obviously, because, you know, it's part of like my heritage too.
Right.
But it also seems kind of like you said, like you're behind the eight ball up there. Like when you, in, again, you started the band in the early 90s, you're a teenager, late 80s, early 90s. Like, how are you finding, you know, bands to kind of shape what you want your band to be like? Are bands coming to Montreal as frequently as they, you know, as they were back in the 80s? Because metal was, you know, on a big, you know, upswing.
It's a completely different scene now. You know, there was this attachment back then, and where we had we had a store called Rock and Stock, mm-hmm. and in Montreal, that was the Mecca where all fans of metal would go buy vinyl and CDs, and that's where all the bands would kind of go on Saturdays or Friday nights to see who's there, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, it'd be like, it was almost like it, there was so many rivalries, right? Yeah. And everybody wanted to be a rock star at 16, you know, but you're playing death metal, you know what I mean? And nobody could really play their instruments too, right? So we, like, it was just funny because, you know, we'd be going through the vinyls. Dude, that's the dudes in Gore Guts right there, you know. Yeah. like and then dudes from Cryptops here across, and then you respect each other, but it was one of these things, like, you go through the vinyl guys passing, like,
yeah,
you know,
the competition. So, but still
nodding your head, you know, hey, what's up, you know.
Yeah.
But and then you would feel privileged if the guy that's behind the counter selling the stuff would play your record because you're in the store.
Yeah.
Oh, not cool, you know, you made it, you know what I mean? So it was kind of, there was this innocence about it that's gone, and it's, everybody's in their homes, everybody's online, they're going, you know, finding through the online system other members to maybe play music in their neighborhoods or whatever, how they do it, I'm not sure.
Or the world, yeah. I mean, people.
But for us, it was like, you know, high school. This band was formed out of high school. So we were only like five metalheads, and we decided to form a band. You know what I mean? Everybody was, you know, sporting the rap, you know, the Ice T-shirts and Ice Cube shirts, yeah, back then, whatever it was. Then we were just like, you know, with our Testament shirts and Metallica and like being rebels, you know. And then yeah, we were the only five in the whole school. We formed Cataclysm, you know. It's kind of like that, you know. And I think that innocence is kind of organic. That's kind of missing a little bit right now because yeah, we got to do it through these different channels. That's all.
Hey, what's up? It's Lurk. Looks like you're enjoying the podcast. If you are and you like what we're doing here on the Van Flip, why don't you go ahead and pause this, give us a rating and review on whatever platform you're listening to. If you want to find out any information on your favorite bands from the hardcore and metal scene, visit lambgoat.com. And to stay in the loop about everything that we post on lambgoat.com, make sure you like us on Facebook and you head over to Twitter and Instagram and follow us at lambgoat. Are you a full-grown adult and you also have a TikTok account? Congrats. Follow us on TikTok as well. You can find us under the username lambgoat.com. That's spelled out D-O-T-C-O-M. Head over to our YouTube channel where we have all of these podcasts in video format, plus a lot more content that you should check out. Make sure you hit that subscribe button and you hit that notification bell so you're always alerted when we upload new content. And last but not least, if you want to follow me, Lurk, the host of the show, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at LurkCity. And as always, if you need any of the links that pertain to the artists on the show today, Lambgoat, or myself, you can always find them in the description. Thanks for listening to this message. Now let's get back to the show. Yeah, I was gonna ask you, like, how could you kind of supplement that innocence? Because, you know, it is different. It is different these days than it was 15, 20, 30 years ago.
Shows, you know, yeah, it's the shows have remained. Yeah, yeah, the shows have, right? So the shows is the spot now. Like, it's the only thing left, yeah, where like-minded people are going. That's where the outcasts, you know, society were going into, yeah, this metal bar, and we're going to listen to this music nobody could stand, and we understand it, you know, and that's what it is.
Yeah,
know?
That's pretty true. It's pretty true. Did you, when you transitioned from bass to vocals, was that around the same time, or when is that in the timeline of, like, switching from, like, this, you know, speed metal, like, straight to your face kind of band to where you're, like, concentrating more on, like, how the song's presented? Like, is it some time around that, or is it before or after?
Yeah, so I've always been hands-on with Cataclysm from day one. I was always, you know, I also was the guy that spoke English. Everybody was very French. So, like, I was the only one that had outside world communication.
Oh, yeah, good.
so that was, you know, I'm Italian origin, and in my household, they, you know, you got to speak all the languages to make it, you know. Yeah. We had that thing, you know. So I learned English through Sesame Street, from what I remember.
Nice.
So that was when I was a kid. You know, it was the writing process and the music all came natural to us at that time. Like I said, it was a very organic type of feeling, and you know, the competitiveness is what kept us going and getting better and getting noticed. You know, I think that was the thing that you know, it drove us to excel as much as we could, you know. Even when we did our first demo, Cataclysm, you know, I remember I had already a business mind, I guess. We printed 1,000 demos,
Wow. Right? Wow.
Those cassettes, 1,000. And everybody's like, dude, just do 200, you know? But I was like, no, we're going to sell 200 and keep get our money back, but we're going to take the other 800 and we're going to send it everywhere around the world. That's what I did. I sent it all over Europe, and then everybody was concentrating who's going to dominate Montreal. And I was like, I'm not going to play this game. I'm just going to send it everywhere. Yeah. So I did that. And then, you know, radio stations, we used to do like these, how do you call it? Like pen pals, like, exchanges and like trade stuff. You know, I'll give you my demo from a band in France and he'll send me his. And we started communicating and building these like lines across the ocean, you know, and which I thought was awesome that somebody in France knows my band now.
Yeah.
Not just one person. I made it, you know, in my head. So as a 16-year-old or 15, and then eventually it got to record labels. And that's when Nuclear Blast discovered Cataclysm. It was, it ended up in a pile of shit, you know, basically like big basket full of tapes. We were happened to be on the top, mail order guy over there, because the company was, I guess Nuclear Blast, when we got there, they didn't even have an office yet. It was all happening out of Marcus Tiger's, the owner's basement.
Wow, yeah.
So, because the label was so small, and this guy was helping him pack stuff and ship out stuff, and then he's like, put the tape playing in the player while they were working, and he's like, dude, this thing's crazy. So he just brought it to Marcus, and Marcus was like, holy fuck, I'm gonna sign this. And that's how it happened.
Yeah,
it was just, tape got sent there, ended up on a desk, and here we are, you know, kind of situation. I still remember getting the letter from Nuclear Blast, we want to order 200 demos and we like the band, are you guys available? It was like, okay, you know, this is going to go further than what I expected.
Right, right. And you comped, you recouped that 200 tape investment.
I sold them all. So it was, you know, especially after we got signed, that demo was now becoming, you know, I don't even have it. So I don't know where they get. So I know it's, if you find it on eBay, it's probably like $60 now or something like that, or $100, you know. So it's rare.
Go ahead. Finish.
No, but that's how it pretty much the ignition of the industry over there was like that. You know, was Gorguts was the first one signed to Roadrunner at that time, and they created a huge buzz for all of us because it was showing the world that you can get signed. You know, and it was already like, okay, it's not only Voivod, which is like was the pioneers of Quebec metal, but they were very progressive and different and thrashy, and but we were very extreme. But again, Gorguts got signed. It kind of opened the door to possibility. So that was very important for us. And then from there came Cryptopsy, Despised Icon, and all these other bands.
That really does a testament to, like, you know, you guys' work ethic and, like, your mindset. Because obviously you were signed almost, you know, immediately after making the band, sending out thousands of demos and stuff like that. damn, what I was going to ask you just now, anyway, moving on from that. You were with Nuclear Blast, and you've been with Nuclear Blast for, like, I would want to say almost 100% of your time that you guys have been putting out records. Am I wrong? Did you put, like, one album out with someone?
One record between contracts where there was a couple of shifts of office people that didn't agree with our future or something, and we didn't agree on terms. So for one record, we went to Universal in Canada and released a record there called Victims of This Fallen World. It was also the first album we did with the new lineup, which was the current lineup. And that was in 97, I believe. But everything else was Nuclear Blast, 100%. Like, so they released 14 records, they've released one EP, and they've released a bunch of DVDs for us. So like they put a lot of stuff out for the band, at least 15 releases minimum. So we are the oldest band signed to the label. Not the oldest by age, but the oldest band that's like the length, the
tenure,
longest.
Your tenure has been there longer.
The longest. We've been the longest and the most consistent from the beginning, even more so than Meshuggah, because they're not even there now. And Hypocrisy would be the closest second to us. But we were like the D band for all. They were kind of the pillar there, you know, like, of, hey, you could be with our same company forever, you know, this kind of thing. So that was, for us, an incredible journey because we outlasted the owner. So the guy I told you, Marcus Steiger, sold the company a few years ago to a digital company. We still here. He's gone from his company. So, yeah, I think we're going to go on 30 years with these guys. It's pretty crazy. When we signed with Nuclear Blast, they were barely 5 years old.
Wow. Yeah, so you've been with them and you've kind of helped them grow. And, you know, it's a budding relationship where you're helping each other and whatnot. And
we showed the world that you can have a career with a record label if everything goes well. The other band that's like that, I would say, is Cannibal Corpse with Metal Blade.
Yeah.
So it's like we're the two bands, like we stuck with our record label. We're also the two most consistent death metal bands when you really think about it. We never took more than 2-3 years without records. We've been both bands like this, you know. Obituary is there, but Obituary did take like a 5-6 years. Yeah, so we've been consistent, you know, like Cannibal. I think the two bands have been like that.
Yeah. I was gonna say earlier about fucking your work ethic and sending all that stuff out at the beginning of, you know, the band. I heard about Cataclysm. I mean, I saw band t-shirts before I heard Cataclysm, and this is probably like middle school or high school. I was probably like, some of my friends or some kids in school had like their older brother's t-shirts or some shit, and I just remember seeing the logo for as long as I can remember. But I, at the time, I was also so young, I wasn't into heavy music, you know. Right. I didn't have like an older brother showing me stuff. I was like the only, you know, I was like the radar for myself, so it took me a while to fall down this rabbit hole. But I remember seeing, like, you know, the imagery and the logo way before I ever fell down the rabbit hole. So it's crazy because, you know, talking to you now and hearing you about, you know, 16-year-old you just sending out 1,000, you know, demo tapes, that makes sense as to why, you know, you would have gotten signed quickly and why I would have known about you in Florida as like a, you know, a teenager, while you're a teenager up in Canada, you know. So it's crazy.
Yeah. And it's crazy because it spread way more than I thought. Like we were getting responses all of a sudden from Paraguay. Mm. We're getting response from, you know, South Africa. Like, it's like there's a tape that made it all the way there. So it was interesting to see that happening, you know. And we had no email. There was no internet.
Yeah.
It was, for us, the internet was the fax machine, right? You get a fax, it's coming out like, you know, super slow. And if you see the Nuclear Blast logo, I'll tell you a story, like, which is funny. I remember when I was fighting with them, specifically when we were split for that one time, and I responded to them something pretty nasty, and then there was I remember the logo popping out, the fax machine coming up like this slowly, and then I start reading, "Fuck you too."
Yeah.
Like in a slow motion.
Yeah. It's a slow burn. It's a slow burn.
The owner, it's like he wrote in a piece of paper by hand because I was like, "Fuck you guys, you know, you're not gonna take care." Because at that point, you always think everybody's ripping you off, and it probably were, you know, in their own corporate way, and same way Spotify's doing it now for whatever. If you want to go into that, that's another thing. But it's the fax thing that I still remember. That was the email where I'll just text you, "Fuck you."
Yeah.
The guy was just standing, and I was just reading it. She's saying "fuck you too," you know.
It's like, son of a bitch. Those are fun, and like, obviously you probably had a fax machine at your disposal. But for those who are too young to remember or don't remember in general, sometimes you had to go somewhere to fax something, and it cost like a dollar or something to like send something. So, it's crazy.
We had bought a fax machine to our manager at that time, right? Mm-hmm. Because that was the thing, you know. And I remember when we fired him because we weren't getting along at some point, you know, and we went to his house and he was, here's your fax machine.
Thank you.
So it's like, it's just, you get nostalgic in a way, but then you start realizing how fast everything went from that time to now. And the most important thing is that we're still relevant. Mm-hmm. Like, we're still out there, you know, drawing people, doing things, selling records. Our Spotify numbers are bigger than ever. It's crazy to see that type of evolution, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
What do you think helps make you continue to be relevant? Do you spend a lot of time with your ear to the ground on like new trends in metal or new bands and stuff? Or do you just kind of like, you guys stay in your own world, create whatever
you
want?
I keep an eye on it because I think it's important to see what kids like now. And I understand that thing. We're not going to go into the look department if we don't look, you know, we're going to put skinny jeans on and go in there and try to be
Oh, you
that.
should. That'd be cool. That'd be cool.
Probably won't even fit, you know. But I was just more kind of like, you know, okay, what we could do is modernize our sound, right? Because I think that the audio of the world is changing, is getting more perfection, it's getting more big, crazy. And so that's one big move we've done in the last, I would say, 6-7 years is change our sound. It sounds way more beefier and bigger.
Do you mean like in post or in the recording process, or like change your sound as a
process,
band?
Okay. Yeah, in recording process. We're going to 7 strings now and like just everything. Okay. We changed that dynamic of the band, and that helped us get the younger generation like, hey, this sounds like something I like now, right. You know. And the older guys were a little bit like, oh, I like the other tuning, but I do like your music, so I'm sticking on board. So kind of gave us that extra jump, you know. So I do that, but the one thing that I learned that's very important in music, and this could go out to any band that's out there now they're doing this, trying to make it or whatever. Don't compare yourself to others, because it's going to be a losing battle forever. There's always going to be somebody that's going to do better and bigger, but you can see, for example, as them as an inspiration versus that competitor. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So a lot of bands want to outdo everybody, and then they start copying those bands because they want to beat them, and they think that's the direction. I think every time we've done our own thing, we haven't thought about that, and we just did what we felt we wanted to do and stay true to our music, our sound, for example. But be innocent about it. We've done great records. When we tried to kind of, hey, you know, we have some momentum, why don't we try this because this is working now? That's when we stagnated or we had issues, you know. So being true to yourself is very important. Be your biggest judge.
Is it hard to be hard on yourself when you do things like that? Like when you try to, like you were just saying, like something's getting momentum and you try to go down that trend and it doesn't work for you guys. Like, what is it like as a band to sit back after everything is said and done and be like, all right, well, that fucking didn't work.
Right. So 50% of bands will quit.
Yeah.
Or you have a band member leave because he's going to feel like, okay, this ship's going to sink. You know, you got that, right? The thing you have to understand is that there is no band in history, including Metallica, that's been on an upward thing forever.
Yeah.
There is, you know, they went with the Black Record. I think that was their peak as far as popularity is concerned. They just remained there, but they never really, you know, I think musically they have gone down. Like, I don't like what they've done in the last few records. Some of them are okay. You know, that's my feeling. But their bass is so strong and classic and legendary that they don't really need to. People are cool with that and they're good, you know? So it depends how you gauge yourself, because everybody goes down. I remember seeing Slayer at the Verdun Auditorium in Quebec with 5,000 people there. And it was Slayer Testament playing. It was one of my first shows when I was young. And I was like, like freaking out, you know, shit, I'm in an arena 5,000. But then I would say 10 years later, Slayer was playing the Spectrum, which is like 1,000 cap.
Yeah.
The Metropolis, 2,000 cap. It was dramatically lower. And it was when they were in the downtrend, you know. So it's but then they came back up. So it's all about the time. There's shifts in music industry, you know, when the grunge took over or whatever. So there, you know, it's all about patience and believing in your music in the end, you know.
That's good. It's interesting that you can. Yeah, what led you guys to like just not give up then? Because I mean, you guys, God, I guess, okay, this, let me preface that question with this question. Has Cataclysm, and again, you don't have to answer this because this is probably in depth behind the industry, like an industry question. But do you has Cataclysm always been profitable enough to where like you guys can focus mainly on that? I know you started and you were signed at a very young age, so you know your work history as far as like career path and or like side jobs outside of the band may not be as prevalent. Because again, you guys have also had a large body of work and a long tenure, so. You know, have you guys been able to sustain yourselves to where you can just focus on the band completely? Or do you have to have side gigs? Or do you just enjoy having something else outside of music?
So Cataclysm, for sure, it took like it was about 10 years before we were making enough money that, for example, we could pay like live in an apartment and pay all our bills. And
separately or together? Sorry.
Everybody could do it separately.
Okay.
So it took about 10 years of that, but 10 years of hard work of stay with your parents. Don't go on. Like, we were like, don't move out, dude. Like, yeah. Some guys were like, yeah, but I have a girlfriend. I said, dude, give it another year because you're going to need so much money. You won't be able to sustain, you know?
Right.
And then some of them left and they were like, dude, the girlfriend's making more money, so we're good, you know? so we had those type of situations that we went through. But Cataclysm, I would say when we were in our mid-20s to about our mid-30s, was doing really good financially. Then life got more expensive. You bought houses, you got kids, you got all kinds of stuff. And some of us decided to do extra things on the side. Like my guitar player, he's a producer. So he produces a lot of our records. He's produced the Despised Icon records, Misery Index, or like a lot of bands. So he's a producer. He does that when he's home, you know. I'm just a crazy workaholic. And I started an agency out of California called Continental. Right now, probably two out of three tours you go see are our company.
Nice.
I have a management company also. I threw myself into that because I had an early understanding of how things work. So I manage a bunch of bands in the metal scene. So I had with my company called Hard Impact. And I was just obsessive about working this industry, you know,
yeah.
all facets. Also, the paranoia, you know what they say, the paranoid survive. I have a little bit of the paranoia. So I was like, I want to do this forever.
Yeah.
So I built my own agency so I could give myself work all the time too. I was like, I did it here. I did it in Europe. I'm partners also with an agency out of Europe called Decibel Touring. That has Cannibal Corpse on and a couple of bands. And we we're self-sustained in the industry.
Nice.
I got a producer, I'm an agent, like we have all kinds of stuff like that. My drummer he's a very important drummer, James, in the industry. I mean, everybody knew him even before he was into Cataclysm. He has his old clinics and all that stuff. So we're all music related, but we're all self-sustained. We don't do anything else as far as like outside music, for example.
And that's, you know, after the first 10 years, for the most part, it took 10 years to get to that point.
So it depends. See, like if we would have stuck with, for example, those first 10 years were very tough, right? Like that's where you're building and you have to invest. But we were very good about how we spend our money. Like we weren't going over, like doing explosions on shows and let's do this big production and then go home with like minus $5,000 or 10. We were very like, let's take care of ourselves first. Let our music do the work, let our music speak for us and just have a good setup on stage and let the people, you know, do it like Pantera did it pretty much. I love how they did it. They never had anything spectacular. It was just Pantera on stage. You kick everybody's ass and they were rebels. And we wanted to kind of have that type of feeling. That's what we do. You know, Lamb of God kind of did the same thing. They were a crazy band. And as far as aesthetics, you know, so that was the tough part. What I'm saying is that the 10 years after that, we made enough money to survive, right?
Right.
But then, you know, you want to move out of an apartment, you want a little bit bigger, and that's where we had to take decisions. We could have stayed like that, and a lot of bands do. You know, they're happy just, you know, I'm free. So it's like, I don't have to go work a 9-to-5 job, and they're happy. But we wanted a little more for ourselves, and I think that's why we expanded that way, you know, because in a way, we're doing death metal.
Of course,
you know, there's a limit to it. You know, some bands say, no, sky's the limit. I know, but there's still a limit, you know?
Yeah.
Not everybody's going to get into this.
I mean, the sky's the limit maybe at some point, but we got to get that audience, we got to grow that audience a little bit bigger every day, because it is kind of small compared to everything else out there in the music industry. One of the questions I was thinking of when you were talking about your stage show and, like, the cost of touring and stuff like that, do you guys, like, how expensive is it for you guys to tour these days? Do you guys, like... Do you cut back on the live show because of that, or is it something that you're willing to spend on?
There's certain things you cannot do, right? Like if you cut down, for example, on anything sound related, you're just fucking yourself up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not sure if I'm allowed.
You can cuss.
Okay. So it's it's you're going to put yourself in a place where now your fans are not understanding what you're playing. Now your fans are not, you know, you're going to just digress. You're going to go down. You know, you're not going to grow from something like that. So there's areas you cannot cut no matter what. That it's almost better not to play than to cut those areas. And I as a manager, it's the same for my bands. Every time they want to cut something, you're not cutting this and you're not cutting this.
Yeah.
Right. I'll cut some of my commission first. I don't want you to do that because that's going to hurt you in the long run. You know, we have a long vision type of thing. Same thing with this. So today, obviously, it's a new game. There's an adjustment period going on right now. The inflation is out of control. Costs are crazy. Like a tour bus, for example, was, I would say, when I first started, it was 1,000 a day.
Yeah.
And then it creeped up to about 13. Now it's 2,000. So it's that high. Like, I mean, it's a 70% increase, like on everything almost. And gas is crazy. And so, you know, the crazy thing now that I feel is promoters starting to take huge cuts of merchandise in Europe, especially, which would never happen before. Now they're like, yeah, but because it's Europe, there's bureaucracy. So it's not like you're going to, I don't know, fucking, you live in Florida, you said?
Yep.
Where, Orlando?
Jacksonville. I'm up north.
You're in Jacksonville. What was that? Jackrabbits over there, something like that?
There is a Jack. Yeah, we have Jackrabbits. It's one of our smaller venues.
But anyways, So, you know, it's like if that club, you know, they'll be like, all right, give me 10%. And then somebody will go there and say, okay, here's $100. And they'll take it and they're happy. They just took something, you know, which I never agreed to, but it is the game here. Europe is so kind of bureaucracy rules there that it's like, we're going to take 20%, but now you have to pay 20% tax on top of that because the government's on us.
Oh, wow.
So now you're 40% down. And you're like 40. And it's like, bands survive on merch. And this started happening after COVID a lot. You know, like, you know, I remember doing a show in Slovenia where we absolutely killed on merch. I was like, I can't believe we did this in over there. And then I go to collect my money and it's like, I would say a little more than half was left. Oof. And I was like, how is this possible? And they were like, well, the government sends a guy that's gonna to make sure that we collect the 20% tax. So, but you have to pay him 20%. What do you mean? Yeah. Well, for selling the merchandise. Well, what is the government paying this guy? Like $100 to do that? So, but they want 20% for his time. And so, I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, so they, you know, so basically something that they would pay 100, they probably make $2,000 off.
Yeah.
Just for that guy. And then the tax on top. It's like,
that's something we've definitely been covering in the last couple months, more of is merch cuts. And I guess since you're kind of in that side of things a little bit, could you explain like what a merch cut is? Not necessarily maybe for like European merch cuts or, you know, just in general, like what, like do people have to agree to it? Cause I mean, some like I would assume most everyday casual metal or, you know, music fan doesn't have a fucking clue as to what a merch cut is or that there is a merch cut.
It's important that you say that because obviously they might not, what is he talking about? So, for example, if you sell $1,000 worth of merch, let's just throw a number, right? So all my t-shirts that I sold to my fans tonight and CDs and whatever, that's $1,000. On that $1,000, you have the cost, which could be easily, I don't know, $300 worth of costs for the $1,000 or 400, you know, just throwing numbers.
Yep.
Now there you have a profit margin of about 700 or 600, you know, on that $1,000 that's coming to you. You're covering your costs, whatever. Now, don't forget that there's the person that's selling your merch. They also cost money every day, right? They could be $100, they could be 200, depends on the size of the band. So let's figuratively say on $1,000 of merchandise, my costs with the merchandise are about 500, the band makes 500. The club's gonna come in and say, because you're playing in my bar and you're selling stuff, people are buying less beer and alcohol, which I need to cover expenses of the show, which is your salary, which is the security, whatever. So because of that, we're going to implement a 15% cut on your merch. So on the gross, meaning if you sell 1,000, it's not on your profit, it's on 1,000,
right.
We're going to take 150, right? So sometimes merchandisers are really good at it, and they'll kind of play with the numbers, or they'll go to the promoter and say, look, you know, we're just touring band, we're struggling, how about you just take $100? And they're like, okay. Most times they'll just take it, right? What's happening in Europe is that on that 1,000, now they're saying, we're going to take 20%, but then we're going to charge you 20% tax also. So on that $500 that you have, now you got to give 40% to them.
Yeah.
So your profit margin is this big. So it's so, you know, you're left with like, you know, 40, what, half of 500. You make two, you're, on $1,000, you're making $250.
Yeah.
So is this, it's not.
Yeah. And and again, because I would assume the casual fan has no idea, but are these things, because they only see like bands complain about it online or whatnot, and there's no like, you know, for me even, I was like, I don't even understand like the context, because like there's obviously got to be a reason, you know, there's got to be a reason there's a cut, and then there's got to be a reason where the bands are agreeing to the cut at some point, you know what I mean? So that's kind of where like, is it a damned if you do, damned if you don't type thing? Like you kind of feel like you guys have to kind of abide by those kind of standards.
Well, it's to the point where it's acceptable that we can survive. We're still doing okay, not pissing off anybody, and everybody gets a little bit, and everybody, you know, we're getting by, which has been the case for most of everybody's career till now. Mm. Now they're implementing it, right? And then that's the problem. It's the fact that the costs are so high everywhere. Plus, they're taking big parts of merch because everybody's freaking out. So the only way this gets resolved is all the bands get together, they start pushing back heavily against this. Some bands stop selling merch, stop showing up some of these clubs that are doing this. But that takes a global effort. It's, again, same thing as normal things in society when you don't agree with it, right? Some people protest, some people do whatever. This is strength in numbers. It's the same idea, you know? Yeah. It's one promoter versus all the bands. Do you want to compromise? Or if you just keep saying yes, he's just going to keep taking the money. You
know? Right, right, right.
So that's where we're kind of in that position right now, where we're trying to see. There's a lot of bands not happy.
Oh, yeah, Oh, yeah, for like sure. We've
not only like, it's not because the ones that are going to get hit the most are going to be the smaller bands. Mm-hmm. But now the big bands that are doing 10 grand, 30 grand a merch a night, they're starting to feel, hey, wait a minute. There's like $7,000 that disappeared here.
Yeah.
For what? So this is starting to affect the big ones too.
Interesting.
So it's going
to
change.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it changes. And it's good to know it's kind of mostly in Europe, I guess, for
the taxes.
Yeah, the taxes. Sorry.
They're not doing the tax here, right? So, you know, they might, you know.
True, yeah.
So if you're going an arena tour here, now you're dealing with all that.
Okay.
You can't even sell yourself.
If right, you have to have the venue sell it or something.
The venue selling, and they're charging you a ton of money for that. So there's, again, it's like, this is where you get into the business mode of like, is it really worth it to go to the arena, or am I doing two nights at the House of Blues and kind of stay low?
Interesting. So it's not a capacity type of thing all the time. It's fees and tic-tac, you know, taking the money away kind of situation.
When the band gets really rich, and now it's the point of, you know, I just got to show status, I'm going to do an arena tour.
Yeah.
And maybe then if I do the right deals, I'm able to get the merch to where it needs because my management or my people are strong enough to kind of strong arm some stuff. Then you might get those bands in there. But again, that's all elitist type of.
Right, right, right. Huge, huge level.
Yeah.
Only like 0.0% of death metals in that level, if any.
It's maximum. I've always said it for the last 20 years. You made it in death metal when you're headlining House of Blues and selling it out. Cannibal Corpse.
For sure.
That's it.
I agree.
You do that, you made it. There's no 5,000 capacities unless you're a Montmartre with a big thematic thing, and you're stuck with, like, you know, big bands around you, like, you know, Arch Enemy, like you got five bands, and you're going in there, and even then you're maybe doing 2,000.
Yeah.
Not gonna go to the.
But they're drastically different, a Modern Marth and Cannibal Corpse. You know what I mean? I would be way more impressed if Cannibal Corpse was selling out the same room as a Modern Marth is. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. But you know this, to the flip side of what you just said, just a little quick note. Now, if you're a very small band and you're drawing maybe 200 packs, like a 150, or you're in that kind of 100 to 200 people a night type of band, right? Now you're going into the smaller clubs where they don't give a fuck about merch percentages that much. Now you're going to be in the place where it's like, you know, Tom has the fucking bar, and he's like, "Hey, man, just, you know, give me $50 or whatever." It's like he's drinking at the bar while you're playing. If you're in that environment, you might be a little bit in a safer environment than the middle class, which is, again, always the place where everybody hits.
Yeah. It's crazy. I didn't really ever think about the venue owner, you know, using like, hey, you guys are bringing in all these people, but they're not spending all of the money on alcohol. They're spending some of the money on your merchandise. So therefore, I need a little bit of that. I never thought about that particular thing. Because the argument you always see online through bands or through people in general is like, nobody would be here tonight if our band wasn't playing. So, you know, you wouldn't get anything at all if the band wasn't playing, you know, yada, yada, yada. So it's interesting to think of that. Like, yeah, people are coming. Yeah. It's a good thing. So I want to ask you, because, you know, you're a death metal fan. Florida's pretty big for death metal. And you're from Montreal. What brought you outside of the great Florida sunny sunshine and the 100-degree weather all the time? What brought you down to Florida?
Well, my wife's originally from here. She's from Orlando.
Okay.
You know, she's originally from Columbia, but she was here like when we met, and then she moved up to Chicago because I was living in Chicago first. So I moved to the United States 20 years ago.
Okay.
So I lived in Chicago for 17, and I've been 3 years now in Florida. But her family's down here, and we have kids. So when I had the second one, it was kind of like too much for us to handle, like all of them up there. Yeah. So it was, you know, we needed her mom to babysit the kid when I go on the road sometimes, and she got stuff to do. So it made total sense. And honestly, I don't like the cold too much, and I've been around it all my life. This was a very, very big welcome.
Yeah.
You know, I love the sun. I think every morning I get up, I got the sun, and it makes me happy. And that's something that I really, 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 really appreciate coming down here, you know.
Yeah.
And also because we're only locked down 3 months out of the whole COVID thing. I was, dude, I'll never forget that.
You're going to upset everybody now.
I know, but I still remember it when I'm eating a, you know, sandwich in a bar, you know, with my wife having a beer and I'm talking to my friends, oh, we can't get out, you know, like all over the world. Yeah. It was the only place. So I found myself privileged at that time.
Yeah, I agree. And now, I mean, you brought it up, so I've been trying not to talk about COVID stuff, but you brought it up, and I have a certain view of how things transpire. Because again, you know, I lived here, and I was doing podcasts, talking to people all over the world, you know, Europe, Australia, Canada, and all over the country. So it was interesting to see everyone's kind of like, you know, perspective on it. But if you know, you're in a band, you're from Canada, you spend a lot of time in Chicago, and these are all like places where the ideologies are differ, right?
Absolutely,
for the community or for the area.
Yeah.
So you've experienced like COVID down here, and like, again, just like you said, 3 months, I don't even know if it was that long, man. It seemed like right away we were like, oh, well, back to normal, which made it seem not as bad down here. But again, we got crapped on a lot. Florida got crapped on for years about that. But it always felt weird when I was talking
Sweden
to people.
Also.
Yeah.
Sweden also. Yeah. They did the same. Yeah.
But I'd also find like people would get like super worried about COVID, and you know, some people should be worried about it, but it was very weird to see in the music world like people's stances. And you know, I would like to, you know, go back and see if they are still the same, like if their stance is still the same. But you know,
they disappeared, all of them.
Yeah.
They disappeared, all of them. And that's one thing. And a lot of them were my friends.
Yeah,
and was like, dude, what are you doing?
It was a very weird industry to be a part of at that time.
Yes. And, you know, you're telling people what to do. And I especially in metal, like look, I'm not on one side or the other of the fence.
Right.
I've always been anti-political guy. I don't like politics. To me, that's the same thing, you know, on both sides. But this was really weird because we are nonconformists in metal. Like, we are outcast society already. We're not supposed to be with whatever narrative is thrown out there. We're supposed to kind of at least question it. You're not allowed to do it. You know, I have a problem with, there's two things that I think are fundamental and important. The freedom of speech and freedom of choice. I think these two things are extremely important to whatever we do. And me and you are not having this conversation without freedom of speech at all. Okay, there is a limit to certain things. I do agree, but at the same time, you don't have to comply to anything you don't like. And it's like somebody had an opinion about, well, maybe it's too early with the vaccine thing, and blah. That's their opinion. The fact that they got censored, I think, was wrong. Mm-hmm. I think the people losing their jobs over not taking the jab was wrong. Like, so this is obviously my opinion. It was the heavy-handed approach I didn't like, yeah. You know? And what did it take for Canada to stop? It took the truckers to go block the country. And then they were like, oh, no more COVID. Yeah. Gone. It was gone. Like,
I'm sorry
it was
just, about that.
Okay. Sorry, you know what that. I mean?
The memo was lost. It was under this paper under my desk, and I totally forgot to read that memo. It's done. It's been done. Sorry. No, it was very strange, like, you know, because a lot of people didn't know what the future held. And I've never said this on this podcast, so this is probably going to be fun. But I would see a lot of people, like you were saying, tell people what to do. And part of me was like, I don't understand why they're doing that, because it seemed selfish, because obviously, like, everyone wanted to get back to shows. Everyone wanted to get back to life. Everyone wanted to get back to doing everything. It wasn't just like whatever, but I felt like a lot of people in our industry, you know, their livelihoods are on like live events and touring and, you know, selling merch and doing all these things. So I think a lot of them were very motivated to push whatever narrative that they were saying, and, you know, follow this rule, get this done, and then we'll go back to normal. Well, you know, that didn't really pan out like everyone said, and a lot of people did things with not all the information given to them at an appropriate time. So I was really weirded out by that whole thing for that year and a half of where people were just kind of pushing other people to do things. And I always...
They were calling people COVIDiots.
Yeah, or like abusing their power, you know, like abusing their power and fame, or not fame, but their you know, position.
And we're not talking about only death metal.
No. Yeah, everybody. But it was weird to see it in our industry. Yeah,
big bands, right? Yeah. And I was disappointed and sad about it, to be honest with you. I kept it to myself, but every time I posted a thing, it was very neutral, because I didn't know the extent of this thing. I think that everything that happened around this virus at the beginning was important because nobody knew what the fuck it was.
Yeah.
So you don't know what it is, you know? So let's take a step back. They had to close for a couple months. Okay. But once we figured out, okay, it's not too bad. There's ways around this. Not everybody's dying that's getting it. It's not like one out of two, you know, like let's take it easy. Let's slowly start to look at alternatives. No, you know, it's like you're losing your job. Yeah. You're not going over there. You need five jabs, you know. Take one job, you're going to be okay. No problem. My whole thing is, if you give me a polio, like I know we're going a little bit
right,
into
right.
this.
No, that's fine.
If you give me a polio shot and I don't get polio because it works, okay. But I take the shot and then I get it anyways. You can't convince me to take four more or lose my job. You know what I mean? It's like, so where did logic end? Yeah. You know, that was my Goliath is that.
Yeah. Okay.
It's the monster, the machine that's behind all this, pushing the people down and us standing up against it, whether it's whatever corporation, whatever it is that's up there doing all this, or your inner demons, because sometimes it's in here. Mm-hmm. It's us. That's like, oh, you know, once you got that fear, it's done.
Yeah.
Like the fear is the problem, you know, like you're afraid of losing this or doing that. I stood with one person, you know, in my family didn't want to take it. Everybody was like, you're crazy. What are you doing? Like, it was like in Italians, it's like that.
Yeah. It hit me hard. It hit him hard.
But he stood his ground. He was like, hey, it's just not for me, you know? And now that it's over, he's vindicated.
Yeah.
I mean, he's...
Yeah.
Like this, you know, it just looks at you like, you know, like so my problem was the heavy-handed approach.
Yeah.
You know, and we stood with the truckers in Canada when it happened. We gave us support online and behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. Here comes all the promoters in Canada. It's not a good look.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You're supporting, I don't know, racism and all
Nazis,
this stuff.
Nazis, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know what that has to do with that. And I said, there is people planting stuff. There is agendas. I mean, it's not like everybody that's in there, you know, is you know, they want to mandate truck drivers.
Yeah.
Or bringing us the food.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, no, man. You know, it's like they're by themselves in the truck.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, I didn't like it. this record was born out of that because we were 3 years in it, and I saw a different perspective being in Florida. And you know what Florida looked, sounded to me, felt like when I was living here? Right after 9/11.
Yeah.
There was the craziness in the country, but everybody stuck together and were proud to be in a certain place. Florida was like that. Like, everybody was proud to be Floridian. Like, we were free here.
Yeah, you know? We're like, getting dogged on, like, left and right all day from the media. Correct. But everyone here kind of ganged together. And, yeah, it's good that you say that. I also think it's really good that, you know, you got to... I really wish, man, because, you know, we've been dogged... Florida's been dogged on for so damn much about so much, that.
Yeah.
But I really wish that they would... People could change their perspective on how we... live through that. It wasn't the same. That's why we approached that one topic a little differently, because it wasn't the same as like what the television was saying. And
yeah, everything. We're saying like, look, it wasn't as bad as you think it was.
Yeah.
Like we were able to function in a very constructive way. We have the best economy in the country because of it, and a lot of people were fine, and we had less deaths than places where they shut down absolutely everything,
right.
And they were brutal on it. So you can't say that Florida was number one. It wasn't. It was like four or something.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of old people here.
And we have a bigger population. Yeah, a bigger population.
We should have been one.
Heightened older population as well. Yeah.
So I think that, and the funny thing is, everybody that criticizes, where were they coming on vacation?
Well, they also moved here. So, you know, after a while, they were like, fuck it, I'm coming to vacation here. It was fun.
Yeah, but a lot of the critics... came here on vacation.
Of course, yeah.
During COVID,
we were open. So, where else are you going to fucking go?
Where are you going to go? So it's good that I have somebody also sharing the same type of views. I mean, that it was a little bit crazy, the whole thing. Because if you talk about that now to somebody that was against it back then, oh, I don't think it's a good topic to talk about. Now it's not, right? Yeah. So
it wasn't then either, but you know, whatever. Like you said, we're on the backside, and some of us are more vindicated than others. But you know,
I think history is gonna show the truth. In the future, we'll show history that happened here as the truth. Of things, and I hope that's what it is. But big influence on the record.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Goliath. And people say, "Oh, what did you call it, Goliath? Are you Goliath?" I said, "No, dude. We're the little guy there trying to fight Goliath." Yeah. That's us.
Yeah.
You know, like we've always been in the metal scene. You know?
As it should be, like the underdogs joining together, like you said.
Yeah.
Well, Maurizio, it's been a great conversation, and I love that we got to put on a little tinfoil hat right at the end there. We could take them off
just
a little bit.
Just at the end, a little something.
Yeah.
You know
so if, thing, yes. if the fans or a listener has gone this long, they've gotten a little treat.
You know what, man? At the end... it's easy to say everything's a conspiracy, right?
For sure.
We have to live through it and figure out the truth by ourselves, I think. And the last song of this album is called The Sacrifice for Truth. So sometimes in order to get it.
And, you know, it's okay to pull your head out of the world and not worry about it. Like, I do that all the time, you know, because everything could be a conspiracy. And if you really go down those holes... it gets weird and wild, and it's best to like worry about what the fuck's going on in my metal world, and maybe like
Absolutely.
A hobby or two, and just block everything else out because I don't give a shit.
You know, I just do what makes sense to me, as you probably do what makes sense to you. We off to live together and get, you know, I'm all for happiness and just the right things, you know, and logic. Logic's important.
Yep.
When that goes on the right, left side, wrong, and then both sides can be really wrong. You know, I think the middle always has the truth.
Yeah.
And if people are able to balance themselves, I think we're going to be okay. But right now, we're kind of going.
Yeah, we're all over. Some people are now.
Right.
Some people have to swallow their pride and realize that, like, hey, you know, I changed my opinion. It's okay to change your mindset. It's okay. You can do that. I do it all the time.
Yeah. I just posted something about that movie, Sound of Freedom, and that came out.
Yeah.
I thought it was an incredible movie to go watch. So I posted, go watch it. And then here comes the guys. Oh, it's a conspiracy theory and, you know, QAnon, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, movie talks about child trafficking.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bad thing, right? Do you agree with that? You told the guys, like, do you agree or is that a conspiracy?
Yeah.
Because it happens. If people think everything's great and perfect everywhere. No.
No.
Even if it's just a movie and it's fictional to a certain degree, let's say, the message in the movie is important,
right?
Know? Like,
yeah,
protect your children. It's like, what's the problem? No, sure. In metal, we're not, you know, it's like we follow whatever. So we have to come back to those days, man, of being rebels. And
we're getting there.
We're going to do it.
I think, you know, the Florida man is permeating the Americas more and more every day. So hopefully they get bit by an alligator somewhere and they like, you know, turn into a Florida man and then they become, you know, a cooler person, you know. And again,
but they can get freaked out by all the love bugs when it's season.
Oh my God. driving your car around Florida in the summer, springtime, it's just like, ugh, just caked in guts. Got guts all over your car. All right, Maurizio, it's been great. If you don't mind sticking around for 3 seconds afterwards, I get some other things for you. But yeah, appreciate your time. If you've made it this far, Cataclysms, Goliath, 15th studio album's coming out August 11th, which is probably going to be this week. Definitely go ahead, pre-purchase it, buy it, stream it, go see him on tour. You guys got some stuff coming up. We didn't even get into all that, but you got tours lined up and everything like that. So
we will be touring, yeah.
Cataclysm.com. All the fucking links and shit are in the...
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan. And this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.